Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 2 years into his presidency, after hard times, big fights, a midterm setback, and now tragedy, President Barack Obama came last night before the nation and Tucson.
I have come here tonight as an American who, like all Americans, kneels to pray with you today and will stand by you tomorrow.
It was a moving speech, preacherly in a humble way, looking to uplift, focus, unite, not to offend. It was in many ways the president the country has come to know, just more sober. It's been a challenging first 2 years for this president. Now he's regrouping. This hour On Point, President Obama and the way ahead. You can join the conversation. Did you watch the speech last night? Where do you see this president leading now? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll be joined in a moment by Richard Wolff, who's been looking deeply at the team and assumptions behind the first 2 years of the Obama presidency. But joining me first to talk about last night's speech in Tucson before that overflow crowd at the University of Arizona are two former presidential speechwriters. Vanka LaFleur is with us. She was special assistant and speechwriter for President Bill Clinton, is now a partner at West Wing Writers in Washington. Vanka LaFleur, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And Clark Judge is here, was a speechwriter and special assistant to President Ronald Reagan and to Vice President Bush. Today, he's managing director of the White House Writers, also in Washington. Clark, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Clark, first to you. What did you make of the president's speech last night? This was a moment when the heart of the country has been hit, and the president, this president, like presidents before him, called on to step up and speak to that, speak to the moment. What did you make of it?
I thought he did very well. I thought your calling it preacherly and uniting is just right. There were moments at which you sensed he was almost at a pulpit. He disavowed some of the divisiveness of the last few days over this and said it was not a result of the political debates, as clearly true now. And he spoke in large terms. That is what you need to do at moments like this. You need to be someone who steps above the political fray. The Constitution, the concept of the presidency was something that was larger than politics on some levels, a chief of state as well as a political leader, and he filled that role very fully last night. He also did it in a not just a difficult moment, but actually a difficult setting. It was striking that the audience was more like a pep rally audience than a audience in a church at a.
They were looking for a rebound. You could feel it there from all the sorrow of this week.
That's right, and he worked with that well, so that not just for the audience in the hall, but for the audience on television, he was bringing the audience in the hall around to something more that worked for them, but also for the audience on television. So I thought he did quite a good job, and it was actually the best he's done, I think, in quite a long time.
Let me go to Vanka, if I may, just for a minute, Clark. Vanka, that was a tough challenge. On the one hand, you had grieving families who had lost loved ones. For heaven's sake, you had parents of a 9-year-old girl, the mother and father right there in the front row. And then in this enormous assembly hall, a crowd that wanted to find its, what, confidence or even joy again somehow here. And the president speaking to both of those veins and the whole country. What did you think of the way he went at the task, Vanka?
I agree with much of what Clark said, and I think in this speech, in a speech of this nature, the president is trying to do three things. He's trying to console the families and the community for their terrible loss, at the same time to celebrate the lives that these extraordinary people lived, And then talking to the wider audience, not just the large audience in that arena, but also all of us who watched on television, to help us come together as a nation as we go forward. I think he did all of that very well. And on the particular aspect of consoling the families and those who'd lost their loved ones, he did, I think, speak very movingly as a parent himself, and I think that came through very effectively. Certainly, the repeated return to the little girl, Christina, it's just impossible not to be so moved by that story and that loss. And I think the president has always been very good at helping us understand things through stories and through stories of real people. And I think it's interesting how one of his earlier very celebrated speeches, he sort of told the story of American history through the eyes of a 100-year-old woman who had lived through so much. In this speech, he was helping us understand the meaning of our democracy through the eyes of a 9-year-old girl who had not had the chance to live enough.
And this from a president with two very young daughters of his own.
Indeed.
You could feel that level of empathy there.
Indeed.
A speech like this.
I did think one of the emotional high points was when he said, I want us to be as good as she thought we were. I thought that was just gripping.
It was right there near the end. We'll hear some of that. A speech like this is a chance for a president to lay out high elements of vision. The president spoke about moral imagination and instincts for empathy. These are high notions indeed. Let's listen. He was hammering home that message that this is a moment for Americans to regain that capacity to understand and appreciate Americans with whom they disagree.
As we discuss these issues, let each of us do so with a good dose of humility. Rather than pointing fingers or assigning blame, let's use this occasion to expand our moral imaginations, to listen to each other more carefully, to sharpen our instincts for empathy, and remind ourselves of all the ways that our hopes and dreams are bound together.
Barack Obama last night in Tucson, hopes and dreams bound together, that is the language of nearly every president. But Clark, Judge, what do you make of these high points that he's reaching for, that we expand our moral imagination, that we sharpen our instincts for empathy? These are very high concepts. Is that the stuff of rallying? Is he shooting over the heads of Americans or right where he should be?
No, I think this was very appropriate, and it is Obama at his best. This was the kind of tone that he had in the campaign that made him such a compelling candidate. It's also the kind of language that makes him really quite a joy to listen to. So I thought this was extremely appropriate. I'd also say that the section on the little girl, the 9-year-old girl, he brought at the end as a challenge, and that was highly, highly moving. It was the most powerful of his stories, and he used it at the most powerful moment. So it was an extremely well-structured speech as well.
Let's hear that right here. Vanka LaFleur points to it, and so do you, Clark. This is nearly the end of the speech when the president was speaking of Christina Green, the little girl born on 9/11, who had dreamed of maybe, even at her age, a life in public service. And here he is, challenging the nation to live up to that kind of innocent, beautiful vision of what this country should be.
She was off to meet her congresswoman, someone she was sure was good and important and might be a role model. She saw all this through the eyes of a child, undimmed by the cynicism or vitriol that we adults all too often just take for granted. I want to live up to her expectations. I want our democracy to be as good as Christina imagined it. I want America to be as good as she imagined it.
Vanka LaFleur, the crowd really responding to that there in the arena, a very high emotional moment. At the same time, in a most interesting way, in a kind of, you know, just off to the side, he's saying we don't want to take cynicism and vitriol for granted. He didn't go after opponents at all. It was a sort of bulletproof in that way. You could not accuse him of going after political opponents. And yet there is that note. Let's not take these things, vitriol and cynicism, for granted.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's absolutely Correct. I think, like Clark said, this is really a speech about rising above the political fray. And I think, you know, you've called this this program Obama 2.0. As we look to what comes next, I think a key part of the message here is that it is not just about Obama. It is not just about this president. It is not just about one party. It's about all of us pulling together. And
but does that work for this president? We want it to. We want it to, Ivanka. But does that work? Isn't that what he's been saying from the very beginning and often appearing to be, you know, beating his head against a wall?
Well, I was struck in the speech, and he didn't make as much about this as he could have, but in talking about the victims of this tragedy, to realize that there were a number of Republicans at Congresswoman Gifford's rally, that this group of people truly was representing our democratic system as we would hope it would work, with people of good faith, you know, eager to talk to each other, to get to know one another's point of view better. And I do think he was just trying to use this example to help us think ourselves. He used the word reflect repeatedly, that we should reflect. And you talked about high elements of vision. Of course, another very emotional moment in the speech, which was unplanned, but when he was able to deliver the amazing news that Congresswoman Giffords had opened her eyes.
Yes.
And I think, actually, that's also sort of a metaphor for what this speech was trying to get us all to do, to open our eyes and to think, to look inward and to think a little harder about how we work together.
Clark, we've just got half a minute here. A dramatic feel-good moment or possibly something more than that in changing the political climate or not?
Well, to some extent, it will go with the moment and is in the moment and will leave with the moment. But for the president, he has, over the past couple of years, lost that larger message. And he found it again last night. And that is a tremendous plus for him and could well be a great step forward for the administration. Certainly the country wants it right now. And
let's hope we find it. Clark and Ivanka, presidential speechwriters, Clark Judge, Ivanka LaFleur. Sorry, we're just up against the time here. Thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We will be right back. Talking this hour about President Obama after hard times, his midterm setback, and now Tucson, and where and how he leads from here. Here's just a little more of the president last night in Tucson, calling for a new way.
If, as has been discussed in recent days, their death helps usher in more civility in our public discourse, let us remember it is not because a simple lack of civility caused this tragedy. It did not. But rather because only a more civil and honest public discourse can help us face up to the challenges of our nation in a way that would make them proud.
In a way that would make them proud. Civility, the word there. Joining us right now from Washington is Richard Wolff. He covered the Obama presidential campaign for Newsweek. In 2009, he wrote a book called Renegade about Barack Obama's rise to the national stage. His latest book, just out in the last few weeks, is called Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the Obama White House. Richard Wolff, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Tom, great to be with you again.
First, to the speech last night, you know this president well. You've covered him from right inside the White House and followed him on the campaign trail for a long time. We're told that he wrote a lot of this speech himself the night before he delivered it. What do you imagine the elements that this president is balancing in his mind as he prepared to step up to that podium in the big arena last night?
Well, for a start, he loves these big moments. He really rises to them. He sees himself as a sort of clutch player, and this was one of those moments. So there's that personal challenge, which I think he embraces, and like all good writers, he leaves it right up to deadline and beyond to craft his words. What was fascinating was that in spite of all of the expectations that this would be brief and just stick with the emotional, commemorative piece of this, he took it to another level. He couldn't resist making a political and policy debate, discussion, conversation out of this. And
how so? Many people are saying, and he, as you know, assiduously avoided doing that. How do you see?
You know, I the second half of the speech was very much a case for the kind of public debate he has long argued for, and this takes him and us back to that moment in 2004 in Boston when he spoke at the Democratic convention. Because for the last couple of years, at least, and maybe more, there are people on both sides of the divide that have said, why does he want to reach out to the other side? What's the point of this bipartisanship, of this elevated debate? You kind of raised it today. You said, you know, he was very highfalutin and
I mean, he doubled down on the unity message, the not red America, not blue America, the United States of America. You can feel the yearning for that. But you write about a huge fight that's gone on over that perspective.
Exactly. And it's gone on inside the White House. It's gone on outside. People saying, why reach out when the other side rejects you? Here he made a moral, emotional argument for why it makes sense, because we should live up to the ideals, the expectations of people like the nine-year-old girl who sadly died. That's an argument that goes way beyond the does it work or does it not, and of course gets to what they've been debating inside the White House. For the last 2 years, as I explain in my book, that there has been this divide. Do they stick to those themes of the 2008 campaign and before that, the 2004 speech? Do they try and have a different kind of politics, or do you work with Washington as it is? As a community organizer, there's this construct between the world as it is and the world as it should be. Community organizers, the hard punch of politics is that you should just live in the real world. He has always tried to do both and to reach for something higher, something more idealistic. And for the last 2 years, they've been struggling for that balance. I think last night was the moment when he planted his flag in the ground and said, this is how I'm going to be. This is what I started out with. This is what my re-election is going to be. And that frames the next 2 years very sharply with Sarah Palin and everyone else. As they try and throw rocks at him, he can say, well, actually, I'm the guy in the middle who's trying to reach out.
I want to dig into that and where that may go, how he's regrouping, how he's restaffing in the White House for the time ahead. I want to get some feedback here first, if we may, from our listeners. Lots online. Matthew saying, moved beyond belief by the speech, turning point for the president. On the other hand, here's a web comment from Bruce saying, the view that things will suddenly improve because there's been bloodletting of the innocent is to look the other way and see what you want to see. How many times has the president put forward the olive branch? How many times has he had to wipe spit from his face? Okay, it's not all... It's not all kumbaya out there. Let's get a call from Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Michael's on the line. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom and your guests. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I strongly believe that President Obama seized the moment last night, and what he seemed to have lost over some time, he found his voice again. And in the dramatic arc of his speech last night, recapping the stories of the heroes, the stories of the victims,
yes,
and capping it off with a nine-year-old girl at the beginning as well as the end, mm-hmm, was tremendously moving, tremendously inspiring. We needed this speech as Americans, as America. We needed his voice, spoke words that we have been feeling and we have been struggling with. I was also struck...
What about beyond that arena, Michael, though? Many watch beyond the arena, but looking forward, does this cut ice? The president's it certainly moves us. It certainly moves us. And you had people, you know, right, left, and center saying yes to this overnight. But what about beyond this day, that night, Michael?
I believe that he has set a tone that from which we now need to take that message into our neighborhoods, into our communities. I just want to emphasize that we had two speeches yesterday, and the two speeches were contrast in styles. We had a speech from Sarah Palin on video, which was a distant speech, a defensive speech, a speech which also included a line which I find very troubling, with the blood libel line, which is, we know, a historic anti-Semitic slur. That is not the tone we need at this point. The tone that Barack Obama set for us is a tone that in our neighborhoods, in our public discourse, in our communities, in our churches, houses of worship, and beyond, this is the tone that America needs. And our president made us proud and gave us, again, the reasons and the arguments why America put him in the White House.
Michael, in New Mexico, I appreciate your call very much. Richard Wolff, how about it? Not everybody will hold these side by side, but they did happen on the same day. Sarah Palin, with a very professional kind of video released to Facebook, so, you know, by her fireplace, American flag, a kind of presidential setting of her own, Alaska style, and saying, look, you know, bad things happen. Political discourse is tough. Those who looked to blame this killing on politicians, maybe like herself, who have had some pretty rough language out there, she called that a blood libel. What about the contrast Michael's pointing to, Richard Wolff?
Well, it is a fascinating contrast, and this was a time. Look, she has every right to feel under attack and wounded by some of the people who have gone out there and said she's to blame for this awful event.
I don't know about blame. I've never drawn a direct line, but I have said that kind of language, you know, don't retreat, reload, and gun sights over political opponents, that we all need to chill.
Yeah, and the president made that case too, but he didn't say that language had led in some causal way to the killing. He said that if we're going to solve this country's problems, if we're going to live up to the expectations of a 9-year-old girl who wanted to meet her member of Congress, then we have to change the tone, and I think everyone can agree on that. That's a different argument. The problem for Sarah Palin is that she was in defensive mode. You know, to use the president's words, this was a time to think, to pause and say to yourself, are we speaking to each other with words that can heal or words that can wound? And too much of what she said was an attack back, a punching back. That's how everyone interpreted it. That's all the headlines. That's certainly the point of the blood libel line, a very emotional language, and personally, I think, inappropriate. But that's not fulfilling the function of a national leader. That's someone who is speaking to her fans and her own emotions, and it will work for her supporters. They wanted her to punch back. The problem is that there aren't enough of her supporters to be a national leader. There just aren't enough hardcore Republicans out there, and that you need to do something bigger at this time, strike a different tone, and she did not pass that test. That doesn't mean to say her career is over or her race for the presidential nomination, if that's indeed what she's engaged in, is over. Far from it. But it does mean that there's a limit to what she can do in terms of her public discourse and her persona. And I think there's a sharp contrast there. And that's a dynamic not just for her, but for the whole Republican field, because they're going to be tripping over each other to throw punches at this president, and he can now safely stay above the fray. What's tricky for him now is going to be coming out of the fray, because there will be times when he has to debate these individuals or he has to respond to attacks, and he's going to have to come down off his perch. But that's a much better way to go than have to climb up to the presidential perch, because that's not easy.
I want to talk about what that might look like. Here he is once more from last night talking about, in this moment of tragedy, how we handle it and politics.
If this tragedy prompts reflection and debate, as it should, let's make sure it's worthy of those we have lost. Let's make sure it's not on the usual plane of politics and point scoring and pettiness that drifts away in the next news cycle.
The president last night. All right, Richard Wolff, you've looked at what went on in the first 2 years of this presidency, the kind of fundamental tensions that were there in the White House, and some of them around this very perspective.
Yeah.
Who won, who lost in round one, if we can call, within the Obama camp, the first 2 years, round one. And what about the restaffing, the regrouping he's doing now? What's the perspective? What's the approach that you see dominating in this season toward his reelection campaign?
Well, when my book came out, which was a couple of weeks after the midterms, there were many people who said that the word revival, which is the title of the book, should only really be associated with the Republicans, because that's what had happened. They came back and turned things around after 2 years.
Remind us what you were talking about with revival.
What I was talking about was a couple of different things, and it really has come to pass in a couple of months since that election and since the book was published, that for a start, this president has been left for dead many times before. He has been written off. His presidency was over. It was over after the midterms. It was over in the period that I was looking at in this book, after they lost the Massachusetts Senate seat. Healthcare was finished. The presidency was over, and that was just a year ago. And 2 months later, he signed healthcare into law, a historic achievement for the president, for Democrats, and obviously a historic mistake in the eyes of Republicans. But this is someone who has experienced these giant pendulum swings from failure to success and back again repeatedly, and with nothing in between, by the way. And that's what we've seen in these last couple of months as well, a revival of political fortunes that I think has left people stunned. Even though it's happened many times before. So that's one aspect of revival that I wanted to look at, this idea that...
Well, you say revival, but he's got a whole lot less going on for him in Congress right now, and it doesn't look like anything like an easy re-election fight if that's where he goes, and of course he will.
But the second piece of this is that look at what happened in Congress at the end of last year, the tremendous successes that he gained, both on taxes, on the START nuclear treaty, on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and how he did it, it takes you into the second meaning of revival, as I explained in my book, because he did it by going to this bipartisan theme that he obviously struck in a higher register with his speech last night. And that gets you to this internal division inside this White House between two groups. One group I call the revivalists and the other the survivalists. The revivalists are the people who said, we've got to get back to that spirit of 2008, to being the reform guy, the guy who can reach across the party aisle, the guy who can, who is transparent and going to change the ways of Washington. And the survivalists were the ones, people like Rahm Emanuel, the former chief of staff, who said, no, this is about beating the other side down. It's about doing business the Washington way, about being incrementalist, about signing earmarks and getting lobbyists in inside the administration and just living with Washington the way it is. And those two pieces, those two camps have been duking it out. And to some degree, I think to a large degree, a lot of the political revival of this president has become has been the result of him going back to this 2008 persona, these themes that got him elected. Doing deals with the other side, making those compromises, and reaching for a different tone. So for the first 2 years, when you're just debating with Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, and you're doing deals with Nebraska and Louisiana senators, people say, gee, that doesn't track with the guy we thought we were electing. And what we've seen in the last couple of months is a return to that older Obama 1.0, I think.
Maybe some evidence for that view in polls. I'm looking at a new one out just in the last, just today, I guess, saying that Obama's time in the White House has been better than George W. Bush's by a 46-30% margin. Voters saying that. His overall approval rating is up stronger now than it was on the eve of the midterm elections. But there was the shellacking in those elections. There were outcries from Obama's political base with some of the compromises made in that lame duck session, and he's still up against a tough way forward here. What do you see in the new team? What's going to be the leading face of the Obama White House now?
Well, the two most important characters coming in here are Bill Daley, chief of staff, who, although he mentored Rahm Emanuel, has a very different personal manner. This is a guy who has won plaudits for his new job from the Chamber of Commerce, who led the opposition in many ways.
He came out of Lehman Brothers or somewhere. Not Lehman Brothers, but J.P. Morgan. And so, of course, the Chamber of Commerce might like that.
Right, but also Democrats love him. Howard Dean, who was one of the sharpest critics of this administration through the whole healthcare debate, said he was a wonderful guy. So,
because what? He's a get-it-done guy, this son of Chicago's original Mayor Daley?
And because he is also, people know on the progressive side of the Democratic Party that he's one of them, even though he's also pro-business. And that's a Clinton model. He's clearly a guy who was very important to the Clinton and the Gore campaign. And the second most important guy is, I would say, the keeper of the flame on the revival side of things, who is David Plouffe. David Plouffe was the campaign manager in 2008. He has been out of the White House for the last couple of years, coming in now to take essentially the role of David Axelrod as the chief message political counselor to the president.
Mm-hmm.
And he believes very strongly that they have moved far too far away from the platform that they built and nurtured through 2008 of reform, of changing the ways of Washington, of being that inspirational guy who can reach those independent voters. Remember the big loss of the last couple of years. Never mind what's happened in Congress or anywhere else. It's losing independent voters. That's the big voting block that switched sides from 2008 to 2010. And everything we've seen, his approval ratings coming back to 50 points plus, has really come down to pulling more of those independents back in.
Well, you may be right. We've got pushback online. Here's one commenter saying, more of the same, populist in his discourse as Obama, but corporatist in his policies. We'll ask about that and more. Richard Wolff is with us. His new book is Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the Obama White House. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Obama. After those tough first 2 years, after the midterm shellacking, after the tragedy in Tucson, and where and how he leads from here. Everyone saw the president speaking last night saying things have become so sharply polarized. Here he is in Tucson.
At a time when our discourse has become so sharply polarized, at a time when we are far too eager to lay the blame for all that ails the world at the feet of those who happen to think differently than we do, it's important for us to pause for a moment and make sure that we're talking with each other in a way that heals, not in a way that wounds.
President last night in Tucson. Richard Wolff is with us, journalist, author of the new book, Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the Obama White House. Richard Wolff joins us in Washington. I've been looking at comments coming in here and saying, no, the president's wrong. They lost all these seats in the House. The Democrats have to fight. Maybe. Here's a call from Oakland, Iowa. Carl, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I agree with the other folks who've been on the show. Great speech. He's good at that. But his words, to my way of thinking, have almost never matched his actions. Here's going to be the litmus test, as I see it. When the Congress brings to him a massive federal budget that is smaller and does not include all the things he wants.
A Republican budget.
Probably includes a significant reduction in federal pay and federal workforce, as well as a reduction in the federal pensions and certain of the programs. Will he actually bow to the will of the American people who put the people who will draft that into Congress for that specific purpose?
Carl, let me, I get it. I totally get it. You want to see how the president responds. What about the people who put President Obama in office? What about the people who put the Democratic majority in the Senate in office?
Well, they took them back out of the Senate, and they don't have that majority in the House at all.
Yep, that's quite right.
They did not have an opportunity to take him out, or I believe they would have.
Well, we'll see. We'll see soon enough in this next cycle. I appreciate your call, Carl. Richard Wolff. I mean, there it is. In a way, you know, who will this president bow to now or work with now? You hear Carl. He's a Republican in Iowa.
Right.
That's his standard. Will he turn now and work with the House? On the other hand, we've got callers and writers here saying, fight for a Democrat's vision. What do you see coming, Richard?
Well, I'm not sure if Carl is aware that actually the president has cut federal salaries. Or the president was the leader on creating the deficit commission that was initially a Republican idea and then Republicans voted against. He wants to talk about deficits. And of course, the Congress is divided itself. The Democrats in the Senate, the majority in the Senate, and the Republicans in that majority in the House have got to come up with a budget that they agree with first before you really have the president make the decision about whether to sign on or not. So, but he wants to have that debate about spending. And frankly, Carl and anyone else out there who agrees with him, dealing with federal salaries is just scratching at the surface of the deficit problems this country faces. There has to be a much bigger discussion, and there will be, through 2012, through that election and beyond, about entitlements, about military spending, about taxation levels. It all has to be on the table, and that's exactly what this deficit commission was debating and put forward. So,
but are you suggesting he's right on the same page now as John Boehner and the Republicans, that he's like, sure, guys, bring it in, and we'll sign it and go?
What they want to do is have specifics discussed. They want now, in fact, inside the White House, they're looking forward to this moving from a rhetorical discussion about saying we've got to cut spending to actual proposals, because Republicans have been very shy until now of coming up with real numbers that everyone can agree with and say, okay, this makes a difference. Because when it comes down to spending cuts, actually, Republicans have been saying, you can't cut Medicare. That was one of their arguments against health care reform. Part of the reason that health care, under Obama's legislation, reduces the deficit in the eyes of the Congressional Budget Office is because it gets to grips with Medicare spending. So Republicans campaigned against this to seniors, saying, he's going to cut your Medicare. And so what kind of practical, detailed proposals are going to come out of the House Republicans now? And by the way, when you poll that stuff, yes, in general, everyone says cut spending and bring down deficits. The specifics are deeply unpopular. So they have some tough choices to make as well. And the White House is very happy that we get down to the details in the next couple of years.
The president's language stood up strongly for unity last night. A lot of people have been asking, well, what's he going to do in this next 2 years? Does he move to the center? Is there a Clintonian kind of triangulation in store for us here? Is that the right metaphor here, Richard Wolff?
I don't think it is the right metaphor, because he was in that position before he ever had to triangulate. So, but the tone has been very much set.
So you say, but he was described, you know, in all these really way out there lefty socialist. That's certainly not how his political opponents presented him.
No, and that worked very successfully for them. But if anyone thinks this was a socialist president, why on earth did he save General Motors and then sell the shares in the biggest IPO stock market listing in American history? He's a very bad socialist, a very incompetent communist. It doesn't really track. It's worked very effectively politically. But the reality that people have been seeing for the last couple of months, at least in the lame duck discussions, votes, the compromises he's made, the tone of last night, is just very different. It doesn't track with the rhetoric. And so there are a number of people, maybe not Republicans, because they've fixed their minds about who he is and what he represents. But a lot of people, independents, I think, especially, are going to be looking at this president of the last couple of months saying, gee, that doesn't really, he doesn't sound like a tyrannical socialist who's going to steam into my house with big government and take everything away from me. And the rhetoric is just it's out of line with what he's been doing. So, look, he's not going to have big pieces of legislation. It's just not going to happen. They know that. There's going to be some work on regulatory affairs, and there's going to be a huge debate about things like that, especially on the environment. There's maybe some deals on education and energy that will happen. But this is a different interaction between the president and Congress and the president and the American people.
Let's go to New York, Watkins Glen, New York, and Mary. Mary, you're on the air with Richard Wolff.
Greetings, Tom and Richard.
Hi.
My point is about the words that we do use. Tom, in the beginning of the program, you said that something Obama said was bulletproof. And then the guest at that time said, I was struck by his speech. And in the crafting of words, we can talk about events without politicizing them. But we also have to be aware that things that we say can hurt. They can also direct. We used to say sticks and stones can break your bones, but words will never hurt you. Well, they do. And I think we're very intelligent. English has a lot of wonderful words, and we should be using them harm each other, but to help each other.
Mary, I take that to heart, and culturally I agree that is very important. What about politically, Mary? When the president calls out for unity, do you see him accumulating power with that call, or, you know, losing it through, you know, some said before all this, they said that's softness, Mr. President?
Well, I'm not even sure that it's something that he needs to accumulate. As the president of the country, he is at a titular head position, and we look to him just as we look to all our leaders to position ourselves and to see where we're going. I think when we use our words properly and not attack one another and be violent with one another, we can actually build things.
Mary, I really appreciate your call, and we take it to heart. Thank you very much for that. Let me get one more right here. Wyndham, Connecticut. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Tom. You mentioned about where do we like to go from here.
Yes.
I'd like to see him take on the gun lobby. I mean, the ATF answers to the president. They don't answer to the Congress. He could just tell the ATF, you know, if these gun dealers are selling to Mexico drug dealers or you know, the 30,000 people killed in Mexico, or consistently these guns that show up in New York City, you're going to lose your license. You're out of business. He doesn't need the Congress to do that. He could just tell the ATF, oldest law enforcement agency in the United States, tell them that if these dealers are not responsible, and there are a lot of responsible dealers, they don't have to sell to the crazies. But if you sell to the crazies, and if your gun shows up in Mexico, that's it. You're out of business.
Steve, are you? Where do you come down on this? Are you a gun owner? No way, Jose. What?
I own firearms, and you know, I have a friend who's a gun dealer, but he's told me straight out before, you know, this guy's out of his mind. I'm not going to sell to this guy.
Stephen, I really appreciate your call. Okay, Richard Wolf, here's something very, very practical.
Yeah.
Congresswoman Carolyn McCarthy has got a bill out there. Doesn't exactly control guns. It just bans that kind of special big clip that allowed Jared Loughner to go and go and go, to shoot 20 people without reloading. And, of course, her husband was killed when a guy opened fire on the Long Island Railroad with a gun just like that in 1993. People are saying that has no chance to pass. Will the president jump on that to push after this tragedy, this real tragedy?
Well, I think he should. I think that's a very reasonable piece of response to this tragedy, because it's practical, it's realistic, it doesn't actually impinge on the rights and freedoms for firearms owners to a great degree, because they can still own those firearms that the gunman used. The question is whether in this moment you can get reasonable measures passed on anything, but especially, of course, on anything that deals with the Second Amendment here. And that's not just for the president. That is also for members of Congress, too, because people have either not wanted to engage in this debate or try to hedge it, try to say, I'm pro-gun, but I'll vote for reasonable gun restrictions. And this is something that they all feel very personally. And that's why you even have Republicans from New York, like Pete King, coming up with a different kind of proposal about keeping firearms a certain distance away from members of Congress. There has to be some kind of response. They cannot just leave it there, because they all know that they are all facing these kinds of crazy death threats on both sides, and it's something they need to address collectively. And that's, I think, where the president's speech really takes them.
Well, you say there has to be a response, but then, of course, you know, there was the assassination attempt on President Ronald Reagan all those years ago. Jim Brady took the bullet, and you see where that has and has not gone. Call here Eben in Panton, Vermont. Eben, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I'm responding to my question, actually, responding to Sarah Palin's heartfelt speech. I'm not actually a fan of Sarah Palin, so I'm not pointing a finger either, but she talked about men and women not being angels, and we need a government to sort of rein us in.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, where do the Tea Party activists and the Republicans who want to limit our role of government, where do they draw the line? For example, in this case of this shooting, we can react to it after the fact, or we can have proactive government programs which sort of nip this in the bud, give an outlet to someone with a mental imbalance.
Yeah, Evan, I appreciate your call. Our time is short here, but Richard Wolf, it was interesting. The president didn't shy away from using the word government last night in his speech. Sarah Palin, too, in her recorded speech put up on Facebook, you know, saying we're not angels. That's why we need government. You hear Evan's question. Where does that debate go that got so hot last year before the midterms?
Well, this is going to be the subject at the heart of the 2012 campaign, which is already upon us. So whether it's about the balance between business and government on regulatory power, whether it's about a response directly to this in terms of either mental health or gun control, that's the essential ideological, philosophical debate that's going on. It may be marginal to a degree because we are going to be talking about regulatory power. It's not about big pieces of legislation. But the role of government, the purpose of government, the nature of it, I think is important, and it's going to come back as well to the last couple of years. Did government do the right thing in bailing out the car companies and saving Wall Street from itself? Was that an appropriate use of taxpayers' dollars and borrowed money from China? This is where the debate is at, and it's not enough just to punch the other side or to say I'm on one tribe or another. It really does come down to a very practical discussion. What's the size of government? What do we cut? What is an appropriate thing for us to fund? And that's where it should be. That's what politics should be about.
So in terms of the Obama White House, here we are. You could call this, once again, a kind of watershed. We had the midterms. We'll have the State of the Union speech soon. But this tragedy has really got people's attention in a huge way. What do you see being the same in these next 2 years of this term? What do you see as being different out of the Obama White House, Richard?
Well, what's really different is that the president now has the space to say, I'm the grown-up in the room. There are people on both extremes. They're not going to go away. We all know that this debate is going to descend very rapidly, if not today, then tomorrow, back to the finger pointing. But he can say, as he did in 2008, as he's done through the start of this deficit discussion and healthcare and everything else, we have to be reasonable. We have big challenges. And
let me just ask, I'm the grown up. We have to be reasonable. That sounds great. We want grown ups. We want to be reasonable. But are those winning messages, winning strategies?
Well, that's exactly what he presented himself as in 2008. That's why he won independence by double-digit margins. When he negotiates just with Democrats, when it's about finding the backroom deals with certain industry players, it doesn't track with that essential persona that he had as the changing guy who can bring about reform in Washington. And that's always been his platform. To the extent that he drifted away from it, independent voters especially drifted away from him. And that's the kind of revival he really needs to remember as they try and build their way back to 2012 and their own reelection. Because if he is just another Washington politician, then there are plenty of Washington politicians to choose from. That's not what we saw last night, and he's going to have to work hard to hold on to that.
Looked epically sober last night, as befitting the occasion, but very, very sober, and has looked more sober over this time. Does this president, this man, still have the spark, still have the fight for these next 2 years, Richard?
Oh, he's a deeply competitive guy. Absolutely. He may say that he wants everyone to get along, but he also wants to win.
Richard Wolff. His new book is Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the Obama White House. Richard, thanks very much for being with us today. Really appreciate your time and thoughts.
Tom, thank you. It was a great discussion.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.